First shot, backcourt, front office.
John, did you hear from any like Patrick or Silas?
Not that I recall.
Joe.
They may have discussed it at the planning commission meeting. You guys remember who said they did?
I just remember Pat Silas saying that he might miss both, but I know definitely the next planning commission.
And did Pat say anything? I kind of have a vague recollection that he was here.
Well, let's go ahead and get started because I have 6 o'clock. So let's start on time, get things rolling. I want to welcome everybody to this joint study session with the Planning Commission and also the City Council. And it's always great to have the Planning Commission here. Before we begin, if you would all stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance with me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll do roll real quick for the record. Joe, if it's okay with you, I'll begin. Then you
absolutely.
Can, all right. So I'll start to one. Joe Burns.
Present.
Chuck Owen. We know Chuck had asked for permission to be dismissed. So 65th wedding anniversary. Brendan McGoffin. Not here. Sarah Diamond.
Present.
Nick Lavaca.
Present.
And Joellen Kesty.
Present.
So we're missing Glenn and Chuck this evening and Brendan. So go ahead, Joe.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Danielle Freiberger.
Present.
Stacy Penno.
Present.
Eric Johnson.
Present.
Joe Fournette, not present. Silas Maddox, not present. Joe Fertizzi, present. Patrick Huggins, not present. Thank you.
So I want to take just a few minutes here. We received something today that was, I think, really quite honoring. There's a lot that our staff does, and I wanted the Planning Commission to hear this because oftentimes you're involved in some of the decisions that are made on different things. And so I want you to celebrate with us as we celebrate our operator, Nathan Salcina, and his crew. And it says, this comes from the American Legion, George Baldridge, Post 43 here in Cedar Woolley. The Honorable Julia Johnson. On behalf of the officers, men and women of the George Baldridge Post 43, I wish to thank you and the Public Works Operations Supervisor, Nathan Salcina, and his crew for the joint venture in the replacement of the flagpole receptacles at Union Cemetery. The task has been a project that has taken several years of planning. Over the years, there have been a variety of receptacles that have failed at the completion of the Memorial Day ceremonies. With the addition of these new concrete reinforced holders, there will be approximately 200 available spots to display the casket flags and are so proudly flown for those heroes who have served this country with valor and distinction. It is a pleasure to be part of this community, knowing that the veterans are respected members of the City of Cedar Woolley. Again, I want to thank you and your staff, Nathan Salcina, for your cooperation in this matter. Respectfully, Ron Brown, American Legion, George Baldwin, Post 43. Oh, Mookie, that's for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll take it to the crew.
Okay. Can I say a few words?
Oh, no, just, working with all the volunteer groups that we get to do, people forget that we get paid. So, but it's fun to participate and do the community thing. So it's great. I'll make sure the guys get it.
And he's quite humble because I know that he has a boatload, as our staff knows. He has a lot of things that he has to do.
And they took time out of their regular schedule to make this happen. So 4.5 hours of the day, and a beautiful project that will be celebrated for the year. Really.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Before John takes the floor here with the first item, which is a discussion of the 2023 and future comprehensive plan and update processes. I, on behalf of the City Council, want to thank the Planning Commission for your dedication and service to the city of Cedar Valley. I started looking at the things that you have accomplished this year, and I think it should be read into the record. So one of the things that you did do was you updated the transportation element of the Cedar Valley Comprehensive Plan, and that was part of the 2022 docket, but it actually spilled into the 2020, what we were doing later this year. You amended the urban village mixed-use parking regulations after the council set it back for review. You worked diligently on the recreational parks impact fee. With much professionalism and thought, you labored through a variety of materials like the stormwater manual, capital facilities plan, the land use element, all of which will have impacts on our municipal code. Most recently, you updated the Cedar Valley School District Capital Facilities Plan, which will affect the school impact fees, which the city collects on behalf of the school district. And you proposed updates on Chapter 3, additional standards to the Central Business District, as well as Chapter 11, definitions to the Cedar Valley Design Review Standards and Guideline Manual. You updated the capital facilities element of the Cedar Valley Comprehensive Plan to address the school's facilities, the school capital facilities plan. And currently you are addressing possible amendments to Title 17, which is retail use of the breweries and distilleries. You're looking at that right now, which could have a good impact on our economic base, especially if it's done right and if it's coded right. So with that, and along with a myriad of other public hearings, which I know you all did, we thank you very much for the work that you have done. You help make our job easy. Your guidance, we appreciate. We know you spend a lot of time reading all of this, studying all of this, talking about this. And I also want to really credit John, our Director of Building and Permits, because I know that his guidance has been really helpful in leading you through the process. And John, you hear what we have to say as well, and you take that back to the Planning Commission and you share that with them. And so it's a good partnership. It's a great venture. So I want to thank you all for what you do. So thank you.
You're very welcome.
I'll turn it over to John. Thank you, John.
All right. Well, thank you for mentioning the Planning Commission recently reviewed the updates to the comp plan, and then at the last council meeting, haven't had a chance to tell the whole Planning Commission yet. The council passed the amendments as recommended by the Planning Commission. So everybody remembers that process. That was an update of various parts of the comprehensive plan, just to update things that have happened over the past year. Every year we give the public the opportunity to make request code changes that affect the comprehensive plan. And so that annual process is one small part of the bigger part of what the comp plan really is. So we're required to update the comp plan every 10 years now by the Growth Management Act. So I want to tell you this because this is the process that we're going to be going through over the next few years, as we do what's called our GMA periodic update. And this is our major update to the entire comprehensive plan. Updates to the urban growth area boundaries and updates to our critical areas ordinance. So these are all things that are required to be updated per the Growth Management Act, which I'll refer to as the GMA. And so we've been fortunate in this period where we've had these major updates in 2016. So now we've been able to just do little updates of things that have come along since then. Things that the City Council has wanted to see pursued changed in the comp plan, or the Planning Commission and the public.
So that bigger process needs to be done by June of 2025. So I think I've talked to the council and planning commission about how this works, and I'll try to give just a quick rundown so you know overall what's going to happen. So we have to update our urban growth area, and that's a process that we enter in with all of the jurisdictions in the county. And I'm going to describe how that goes right now. So it starts with coming up here later this year, the Department of the Office of Financial Management of the state is going to give a range of expected population growth from 2025 to 2045, so a 20-year planning horizon. The county GMA steering committee, which is the mayors of all the towns and the towns, cities, and the commissioners, the Board of County Commissioners, will then decide what they think a reasonable population projection would be between that high, medium, and low. We've traditionally gone with the medium, and then the planners from all the jurisdictions will make a recommendation to the steering committee. The steering committee makes that recommendation, and then we go through a process of determining how much of that overall county growth is going to go to each of the jurisdictions. Like, how much is going to go to the cities, how much is going to go to the county, and then how much in each city is going to take what percentage of that population projected. And there's also, alongside with that, there's also the employment growth projections. So there's, you know, they're very different things, but they're leading up to the same thing. The idea is we're going to have to then decide how are we going to accommodate the growth that we're expecting. So we'll have a very long public process where we'll determine what our likely population is for each city, and that's going to happen again at the growth at the GMA steering committee part of SCOG, the mayors and the board of county commissioners will make those recommendations, and then the planning departments go through a process of trying to figure out how are we going to accommodate that the growth, population, and employment. And it starts with the land capacity analysis. So first, I mentioned, you know, we decide how much growth we're likely going to anticipate. And then we look at how much land we have within our urban growth boundaries, or urban growth area boundaries in the city. And we actually analyze every parcel to determine, is it developable, or is it already built out, or are there environmental constraints, or are there any other market constraints? And we determine how much land is available for development. And then under our current zoning policies, how much of that land, how much of that developable land can accommodate the projected growth. So we find out we've got X amount of acres of residential land at various zonings. We say it can handle that this number of people. And then we say, okay, well, does all of our residential land have enough capacity to actually accommodate our projected 20-year growth? And if not, then the city enters a process of political process of determining how are we going to accommodate this growth? And we've really got two major ways of doing so. One is to expand our urban growth area to have more room to accommodate the new companies that are going to come here and employ people, as well as, or expand it to accommodate the new population growth. Or, you know, the city council and through the planning commission review process can determine that they'd rather increase densities, for example. So maybe we don't expand our urban growth area, but we allow more people on the existing land that is already within the urban growth area boundaries. Which, you know, would mean, you know, more units per acre. We're not here to debate any of this today. I think the planning department has a pretty good idea of what the council is feeling about how they'd like to go down this road. I'm just describing the process to you right now. And then after we do our determination to see how we're going to accommodate it, then we start, you know, say we have to expand our growth area. So go through a process of public hearings that are at the city level to determine exactly how much land we're going to need to expand our urban growth area. Or if we decide we're going to do higher densities, we'll go through a process of determining where that might be suitable to do so, and have public hearings from people to see what the people that are affected by these decisions feel about what was being proposed. And then the council can always, you know, kind of base council and planning commission based on what they hear from the public comments and the data presented to them by staff can maybe alter their proposals. Again, we're not here to debate any of the merits of this, it's just that those are the potential ways to go. And then once we determine how we'd like to grow over the next 20 years, we present that to the county commissioners through their planning department, and they have public hearings at their planning commission. All of the jurisdictions do so, and we take these bits and pieces that each jurisdiction goes through the same process, and we determine at the county level, is the county going to be able to accommodate growth based on whatever each city is recommending? And if not, you know, there's a reconciliation process, and you know how the any political process goes. Nobody's going to be happy with the final result, but it's a process to do for the greater good what's going to be best for the county and then all of the jurisdictions. And because, you know, the county kind of has the most power in this process, there is a framework agreement that we've all of the jurisdictions have signed that explains very explicitly how we go through this process, how we do the reconciliation process if there's any disputes. The county ultimately holds most of the cards, but we did about 15, 20 years ago come up with this framework agreement that protects the cities from getting run over by the county because they ultimately make all the decisions. And that's a good thing. And sometimes it complicates the process, but this framework agreement has been good for the cities over the past 15, 20 years. Because it wasn't always in the city's best interest. They didn't always get to do things the way they had recommended. So now that's a good thing. Once the county makes their decisions, they're the ones that actually sets the urban growth area boundary limits. So the city makes its recommendations, and we aim to have all of our work done in the city council recommendation to the county at the end of 2024. And then beginning of 2025 through June of 2025 would be the county process of going through more public hearings and approving or changing whatever, but coming up with the final urban growth area definitions for all of the counties and cities. So that's one little part of this GMA periodic update. Once we know what our likely projections of population is going to be and our employment projections are going to be, we go through our comprehensive plan element by element and review our current, so we'll take the capital facilities plan, for example. That looks at, you know, all of our city facilities, our fire stations, our police stations, the school district, actually, although they kind of do their own work, but you had experience with how the school district participates in this process during this last update. And then just, public works operations facilities, sewer, stormwater. So we look at, okay, we're going to be projected growth of X amount in 2045. So we look at the capital facilities element and say, okay, first we know we have these elements or these facilities. So we inventory everything that we have and the number of police that we have and fire and all of that. And then to get from where we are now to where we are planning to be 20 years from now, these are the things that are going to need to be done. And so the police department's going to update their portion of the capital facilities element. The fire department's going to update their part of the capital facilities element. The public works department's going to update theirs. We may or may not have to update our stormwater plan or our sewer plan. We're going to be doing those in the meantime. So we just work all of these things together into that capital facilities element. And that is our plan to accommodate all of our capital facilities improvements to accommodate the projected population and employment growth over the next 20 years. We do the exact same process with our land use element, and that's kind of where we build in these urban growth area boundaries. How are we going to have enough land to accommodate all of these people? And how are we going to follow the state regulations for critical areas protection during this 20-year population growth time frame? We'll also update our housing element. How is the city, you know, what is our housing stock like now? We'll first do an inventory of, and then based on the policies that the Planning Commission recommends and the City Council ultimately wants to approve, how are we going to house these people? For example, is it going to be largely single family, or is it going to be a mix of single family and duplexes? Is it going to be areas where we allow higher density, such as apartments or the urban village mixed use area? These are the policies that we currently have in place and the tools that we have to accommodate the housing growth in the city. So that's a big one. Housing's become a really big deal over the past 10 years as the housing market's gotten really expensive and land supply has changed. So we're going to ask for help from a consultant to do an updated, very comprehensive housing analysis. And then transportation analysis we'll also do, and Mark Freiberger updates that regularly, and he'll continue to do so based on the new data. And we'll do this with all the elements. Those are the major ones in the comprehensive plan that are worth discussing. There's also the parks and rec element, which we've been updating a little bit here and there, but we'll update that as well to make sure that we have enough parks and recreation opportunities to satisfy what we expect to be the good level of service for our citizens as the city grows up. So these are all things that are under the City Council's control as we make policy decisions between the end of 2023 and the end of 2022 and the end of 2023. So these are topics that are going to continue to come up, and we'll seek guidance from you. The Planning Commission will then run the public hearing process, and ultimately it'll come back to the City Council for their hopeful agreement with what the Planning Commission says, or you know, we continue to run the process. And that's when we start early, because we have to be done more or less by the end of 2024. So that's going to be starting at the end of this year. Thrown in there is also we have to update our critical areas regulations. It's also a requirement of the Growth Management Act, is that we review that and make sure that it's still compliant with the best available science. And so we'll be doing that as well during that process. So there's a lot to do during this periodic update. Any questions on the periodic update?
I actually have a question, but before I do, I want to make a note for the record that Councilman Brenda McCoffin is here with us, and also Planning Commissioner Patrick Haggins has also joined us. So. For the record. So when you and I were having this discussion, I was bringing back the materials from the Skagit Council of Governance, and I was asking questions about all of this, because I haven't been through this before. This happened before I even came on council. My concern was that the state would dictate to us what we had to do. Did I understand you correctly, John, and maybe you could explain this more, that yes, they lay out certain expectations. However, after we do our study, we can make a good argument as to why we want to go down which route we want to go down.
Absolutely. So the Growth Management Act is set up as a bottoms-up type of document. So I know a lot of people voice a lot of frustration with the Growth Management Act, but it's not top-down. It really allows local jurisdictions to make the grassroots decisions how they want to grow. There are sideboards on that process saying, you know, there's certain things. You just, no city is going to be able to say, well, we're just going to allow only single family housing. That's not going to meet state requirements. And so there are limits, but as long as we're accommodating based on facts and meeting our responsibility as an urban growth area, then we have a lot of leeway in the way we handle things. There's dozens and dozens of specific requirements that may or may not pop up. Like, for example, we are required to allow ADUs to a certain extent, but we're still allowed to have our own twist on most of those. The state continues to tweak those, as you know, and try to make us do more and more, and that's going to continue. But in the meantime, we still have a lot of leeway in the way that we choose to grow and accommodate our growth.
But that also could be swayed or determined by whatever legislation is passed, like last year they were looking at mixing up the, R5s, and it was like they right. wanted apartments where there was single family homes, and I mean that's what they were looking to do.
And as staff, we follow what the legislature does. Part of my ongoing professional development training is following the legislative updates, going to conferences where we talk about the specifics of those and implementation necessities that are created by these legislative changes. So we stay abreast of that. We try to update, staff tries to update council and planning commission about what's happened and how that's going to affect us in the long run. So yes, if more rules come out like that, that say, for example, requiring more middle housing or apartments or duplexes or triplexes or something like that in what is currently single family neighborhoods, that is definitely something that the legislature has been working towards achieving and has not been able to achieve over the past legislative sessions, but it's going to continue to come back, and we'll see what sort of Frankenstein version of it gets passed next year. And they kind of come out and, grand ideas and then water down to a certain extent or die. So we can just wait and see on that. At this point, anything that passes in 2023, this is a longer session this year, right? So they won't complete their work until March or April. So anything that passes in April of 2023 is going to be challenging for the jurisdictions to incorporate into our 2025 updates, just because there's not a lot of time to react to that new legislation. So we might be fairly insulated from anything that happens this year, or who knows, legislature do what they want.
And I did send out, I shared it with you, and I know you've had these kinds of informational emails come in, but I did disseminate to both the council and to the planning commission ideas that other cities have done where they've actually followed the regulations that the legislature is putting out or trying to put out, and yet they've done it in a beautiful way, where you can walk in a neighborhood and you wouldn't really know that there was, say, a 4 or 5 room apartment on that street. So I guess as if I could make a recommendation to the planning commission, because I just am worried about what the legislature is going to do given housing and the situation that we have with housing, that if they would look at that somehow, if there could be some sort of policy or regulations put into place that would kind of dictate what it has to look like so that we don't lose that that hometown feel, that neighborhood feel. I don't know if that's possible or not, but I'm laying it out there.
Question. So with legislative changes that may come down the pike in this whole process or even after the process, what tools, strategic tools do we have? Like, do we have the ability to, like, I'm thinking of like the change in the marijuana laws where we placed a moratorium, which kind of helped allow us to have a period to not do so much of a knee-jerk reaction and trying to meld what that looks like on our local community level to accommodate requirements and responsibilities for statute. I mean, do we have that same sort of element or tool in our toolbox for, say, you know, a massive overhaul with ADU legislation?
Well, it's really going to come down to how it's written. There's usually time frames by which the cities have to act. More times than not, those time frames are fairly long. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that anything that happens in 2023 is not going to affect your 2025, but it might. And it's just, I don't know how to react to something that we don't know what it's going to look like. I do like the idea of being able to react, but you know, the reason that the legislature gives you time to react is so you can then craft your own twist on the regulations. And regulations usually say you have to do this, this, and this, and then give a lot of leniency to the cities to do it however they want, as long as they meet those core requirements. Can't say that's always going to be the case, but that's what most GMA changes have been like.
You know, just one comment. We've always tried to be very proactive. Like, we kind of know the bus is coming at us. We see it in the distance. I think we've done a really good job of responding to what's potentially coming our way before it actually comes our way. We see what it, we always thought what it was, but we were pretty well versed as to what that moving target kind of looks like, because nothing happens fast in land use. It just doesn't. And here's another thing. Just because we put something on a map doesn't mean it's really feasible to do. For instance, PRD is anything over 40 acres. We have a lot of properties like that, but there's no water. So if anyone wants to develop it, they could potentially have to go up to a quarter of a mile to get to a sufficient supply to even bring into a neighborhood. So it's just not that easy. ADU is a really good example. We were pretty proactive on that. And I think we came up with something that works. The people have not been beating down the doors to put ADUs in their R7's own backyards. Just isn't what happened. So.
Although we're seeing more movement on it. We have more movement. But you're right. And we appreciate the work that you have done on that. Thank you.
Yeah. So John, if I may, are we, I would imagine, having conferences maybe once or twice a year with other cities, or you are, to just see where they're kind of looking at that and how they're kind of envisioning their planning department working on their own towns, and thinking Anacortes, Connor, Hamilton, obviously Burlington, things like that.
So I mentioned there's a plan, what's called the planners group, the technical advisory committee to the SCOG GMA steering committee. So that's the planners from each of the jurisdictions in the county, including three planners from the county. And we meet monthly to bi-monthly to talk about these things. Now, we're not in this GMA periodic update right now, so we haven't been talking about these specifics of each jurisdiction's how they're going to handle it. But we are talking about the process that we're going to be going into as we're all prepping for it to start later this year. When we do start meeting more regularly, then yes, all the planners are in the room together and we're discussing how each of us are attempting to handle it. And that's really important for us because we're all trying to work towards the same goal, is accommodating the projected growth for the next 20 years. And we really have to work on it together, because as we divvy up the population projection, obviously Mount Vernon gets the lion's share.
and you know, Hamilton and Concrete, they're not going to take much. What we do is we generally look at our historic growth, you know, what has been the trend line in each jurisdiction, and we kind of start from there and then run it through the political process to see if that's what each jurisdiction wants to do. So yes, the planners locally are all communicating closely about how we're approaching this.
So it's a lot more smoother as far as the outcome. Everybody's kind of, I mean, everyone's in their silo, but they're also working outside their silos in a bigger silo to make sure that the overall.
And yeah, yes and no, because it starts as we're all in the room together like this, having a discussion about where we think the county's going to go. And then we have a process to say, okay, we think we're going to grow about this much. And Anacortes says they're going to grow this much. And we kind of, does that, we do the math, and does that meet our projection for the city, for the county and the city? And if so, then we go off into our silos and we do the hard work of the land capacity analysis and studying our own policies and urban growth area and working locally to accommodate what we've agreed at the county level to try to accommodate. Say, can we get there? And if so, how are we going to get there? We spend a year working on these things at our planning commission and city council before we go back to the county out of our silos and try to then reconcile all of our silo work.
And part of that's involved with this, what is called SCOG, Skagit County Council of Governments. There's guidance that goes into that, and there's policy that's made. And we do meet every quarterly for the Growth Management Act, overseeing some of what's happening. So a lot of what the TACT group does, we hear about, and we do have some influence in that. So it's kind of a good balance to check and balance.
Is there I know the modeling software for projected growth is costly in a lot of cases. Is there a way to have a collaboration with the communities in the county to get a modeling software and then just kind of see where that throws different areas, or each one borrows it or has a license agreement to that, or is that too much?
So it's part of our collaborative work at the technical advisory committee level. SCOG is they're the administrator, so they've got three planners over there that work mostly in transportation, but some growth management stuff also. And they they're going to be kind of the lead on the determining just kind of doing all the math for us. And they are going to be hiring a consultant to do both the economic development growth projection and the population growth projections, like doing all of the hard work of saying, okay, Cedar Woolley grew at this rate from 1970 to 1990, and every year from, well, I'm not sure how far we'll go back, but it'll be 40, 50 years of growth review to see how we've grown. And so we would anticipate that we would stay on that trajectory, but before we make that final decision, we also look at any new developments that might hinder or cause us to want to take more growth. But these are all before we enter the land capacity analysis process, we'd be coming to council and saying, hey, this is what we're thinking Cedar Woolley might be growing to. What do you think? Before we say, give our head nod to Scott and say, yeah, we think we can do this. Let's start the full analysis. So he'll be in the process. And yes, we're hiring consultants to do the math and looking at the projections.
Would they offer software that has visual projection modeling of showing like houses kind of growing in this area or multi-use centers in this area and possibly plazas within those zones and see kind of how that ebb and flow works, or would we probably not be able to see the visual?
That would be great. I think as the technology's come a long way since 10 years ago when we last went through this process. Before it was mostly graphs and charts,
showing their your population from now to then. But yeah, a visual map display showing where your higher densities are and where you have available land. No, they won't have the the land capacity analysis available to them because we enter that land capacity analysis process after we look at our after we kind of divvy it up in the county level. So that's probably beyond their ability because they won't have the data available to them. But we can, I think that's a fantastic idea and that would be helpful. See if we can get them to do something like that maybe after we've entered the process.
Thank you.
So unless there's any other questions, this was just wanted to touch base with everybody in the room because it's an important topic that's going to be it's going to be a big part of what the Planning Commission does over the next 2 years. And it's going to be coming back to the City Council periodically. So I wanted everybody to understand the process. And I'm sure you're all experts in it now. But if you have any, if you still have any questions, you know how to reach us. We're going to be talking about this more and more often.
When is the projected time when we start to get really heavily involved?
Probably the new year. The so we're not expecting OFM to have their projections for the county until the fourth quarter of 2022. And then the planner group will work together and bring the initial growth allocations to the Growth Management Act Steering Committee in the third quarter of 23, which I think this probably has got to be moved up. But
yeah. I don't think they felt like they would have the studies done by then, which is why they're going to bring it to us at that
point. Yeah. So we'll have, the planners group will be working on it long before the third quarter of 2023. That would be after we've done our consultant work for their projected population and jobs growth. And we've kicked it around at the planners level, not doing full analysis yet, but just like, does it seem like politically where we're gonna go in the third quarter of 2023. And then, yeah, we'd really be starting on the comp plan updates, which mostly be in 2024, but try to sneak some of it into the 2023. That we can, stuff we can work on before we know what our projections are going to be. There's stuff we can work on. And that's what I anticipate being the 2023 comp plan, is these pre-work parts of our comp plan, like our public utilities element. It's not a real hard-hitting document. So we can, it's not based. It has less to do with our future population growth. So those kinds of things we can brush up in 2023. And then 2024, the real grind of updating our comp plan, the meaty sections, which is going to be more than just work for planning staff. It's like I said, the police department's going to have to be doing a study, the fire department, and public works department. So it's a lot of work for our private works department. That's all I really wanted to chat with the council and the planning commission on this issue today.
Are we including the planning commission in the encampment? We are. They're going to be part of that. Okay. I know something that was requested that we didn't get on the agenda, but was that the possibility of maybe doing a roundtable about different things that the planning commission may want to look at and bring before the council and vice versa?
Well, yeah, that's what I was closing out that part of it, of this first discussion. And then the what I was going to say is, now, if there was anything that the planning commission or city council wanted to look at in the comp plan as part of the 2023 cycle, knowing that we're going to have some comp plan stuff leading up to the big comp plan amendment on there. And so
council and planning commission want to discuss if there's any other things that want they'd like to see happening in the comp plan in 2023, now would be a great time. Again, we're not going to be making any decisions now because the comp plan process is open to applications to the public for comp plan updates until mid-January. So then in February, we're going to have another joint planning commission city council meeting, at which point then we'll really say, hey, these are the things that we think we really want to talk address in the 2023 comp plan. But today was a great time to kind of kick around some ideas and have a informal discussion about what you might like to see done in 2023, and then you'll have the next several months to think about it amongst yourselves and maybe come back with a clearer picture in February. So that is the opening for casual conversation about what might be of interest in 2023 comp plan update. So I'll throw it back.
So, and I'm going to throw it right out to all of you. So is there anybody who'd like to start this topic off?
Just want the clear picture.
In our strategic planning session, we kind of talked about incorporating the R15s into the R5s. I bet you guys probably caught that when we did our meeting as far as the higher density growth. I don't know if that's part of the 2023, or we won't really know until legislative staffs on what they're doing. But like what you were saying, Joe, is getting in front of it by looking at that aspect and getting a feel of what the council's comfortable with, as well as understanding what's going to come down by the legislation.
Now, we put a couple of things in place that have coming online, specifically the urban village mixed use concept, where in order to handle the density, we're going vertical, which you see pretty much everywhere, especially in British Columbia, which is a big fan. So we're all wondering, did we create the Bride of Frankenstein or something really effective and beautiful? So I'm pretty excited to see both of those projects, the BYK and the RJ Group projects, go online and see exactly how that worked. Because that R15 is it's a good zone, especially when you go up. So let's see what happens with what we put in place. But we have been flexible to see what's been coming our way, and we've looked at different concepts. We've had hearings where we've had people participate, especially on the developer side. We've gotten a whole earful of a lot of things, but I think we've dealt with it effectively. We have a lot of things coming in place right now. So let's see what happens. Yeah. We got some good things going on in this town. Exciting things.
Is there a... It's kind of hard when you read through the comp plan because it's really a legalese document. It's kind of like you try and put your mind to imagination of what the city's growing to look like, or this in a legalese document where it's like constantly covering. But is there a idea on kind of like a cliff note version of like the planning for 2020? I don't know if it's more 2023 because it seems like it's more of like the 2020 or the 20 year outlook, but how it incorporates in 2020. I guess 2023 comp plan for what we're looking at for that's just adding in for the 2024. So my question kind of goes a little bit beyond that.
No, yeah, so yeah, it's like the 2023 would be kind of lighter stuff. Like what you're talking about is potentially adding more density, you know, middle housing or something, you know, some duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes into the single family residential zones. That would be a something that really changes our how much population we could handle in the city. It would allow a lot more people to live in the city. So that's a bigger change, and that's probably best for when we do our land capacity analysis and we look at how the urban growth area is going to be affected by our projected growth. And that's a tool that we could use, you know, to limit the amount of urban growth area expansion that we would otherwise need to do if we allow a little bit more density in some of the single family residential zones. And we can study that when we do our housing element and land use element updates. And I think, you know, that's an issue that the state's probably going to push us towards. So we'll be working, we'll be looking at what other jurisdictions have done and see if there's we can present some ideas to the council that would be palatable or not. You know, these are policy decisions that the council gets to make. I think that one in particular is a really big one that's probably going to be on the 2024 update cycle, so it'll affect the urban growth area.
No, just a comment that you were talking about on the visualization. Those comp plans are powerful documents. I'm in the real estate business. That is the future of what cities are doing. So what you want to do is look at other jurisdictions' comp plans. You'll see there's a lot of similarities. And then start looking at those jurisdictions that have incorporated those developments based upon what their future models were. Go to the east side of Bellevue, Kirkland, Redmond. Those have always been good examples because that's where the majority of my practice was. But those comp plans are super, super important to visualize what a city is going to be. And we've done that in the past. We've done field trips to other jurisdictions when we were doing UVMU. What looked like setbacks for, you know, different architectural aspects of a particular building, decks, all that kind of stuff. So looking at somebody that already did it, you get to see what you want, what you might not want. So that's a good way to figure out, okay, well, we're going to do this. Go to somebody that's already did it to see, hey, yeah, this works. This actually looks pretty good. And that's what we've done in the past. Those comp plans are powerful documents. It's the future. It's a roadmap.
So they archive, I would imagine, so you can go back to, like, the 2010 comp plan for, like, Bellevue.
I believe so.
And then kind of get an idea today, kind of where they were heading, even though it's changed today's version. But, yeah.
Sometimes you wish you could take things back. We made adjustments here in our own code as we move forward with stuff like, hey, we didn't particularly like this particular project, how something went down, so we changed setbacks, maybe landscaping, things like that. But it's always an evolving process. Letting somebody else go first, okay, and then see what it looked like. That's what I was talking about. Did we create the Bride of Frankenstein with the UVMU? But looking at the one building that RJ was doing, looks great. Yeah. So let's see if we did something right.
It definitely blends a lot more with the siding on.
I was wondering what they were doing.
Yeah, because when it's big and white and it's big, I heard a lot of comments about it. You know,
let them finish it off.
So, is there anybody else who has something that they would like to present as a possibility discussion within the comp plan and related to the comp plan?
So your recommendation, John, for this next, as we're leading into this major review, is maybe not so much making recommendations on more meatier comp plan revisions to kind of maybe hold back on the reins on that a little bit until we get further into that process, or because you had made a comment about not necessarily getting into too deep of a subject.
I think any major policy changes would probably be better as part of the 2024 update, as we're like looking at doing. Well, at that time, we'll be looking at doing major revisions to our comp plan, major revisions to the policies of housing, major. That would be the time, because those major policy changes, such as like how much density you allow, really affect how many people you can accommodate in your growth area. So it stands to reason that you do that during the urban growth area review process, which will just be, I know it's still a year away and there are important things, and I hate to kick the can down the road on important topics like that, but we're gonna be in it neck deep come next year. So I don't know if it's a great idea for us to try to take it on this year without doing the whole meal deal.
Unless it's something to relate it. Is that, I heard you say that, unless it's related to the comp plan itself, the changes that we're going to be making.
Well, yeah, all of the changes would be comp plan related. I just don't know if we want to make any comp plan changes that would affect our, our land capacity analysis at this point.
It also gives us an idea to see what's coming out of Olivia. mm-hmm. right? So we don't know what that train's going to look like, but we know it's coming down the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been derailed twice. But their attention. I think one thing that I know I've brought this up before. I know other planning commissioners have brought this up before as well, and that is the idea of actually taking what we have right now and beautifying it. So, for example, tree-lined streets, especially in those blocks, those areas where we have historic homes, maybe putting together some sort of policy that dictates what kind of trees can be planted there, something that, you know, not high maintenance or grow, the roots grow into sewer system. But that's one thing that I would like to actually see happen. And I guess the other thing is that I know we don't have much say so over this, but are there options for redoing sidewalks so that in those same areas where there are sidewalks, we want this to be a walkable city. It's pretty hard to do when we have sidewalks that have huge gaps in them. So I don't know if that can be addressed or not. I mean, we do already have a policy in place that talks about, we leave it to the owner to take care of that. But you know, is there something more we can do? I don't know if there is or isn't.
I got to be careful because Public Works is, you know, not planning's domain. So I don't want to speak too much for the Public Works Department. I think we can definitely do things like have the Planning Commission work on recommended tree types. And that shouldn't be hard because other jurisdictions have books that about street trees. There's a Seattle book about street trees. Which trees are good and which size, which ones heave sidewalks, which ones drop horrible things onto cars. Yeah. And I know that our guidelines are, we have in our code some trees and we have some, taking the Public Works Department standards, they have some street tree discussion also. But we can definitely help them out by doing more work at the Planning Commission level to address those sorts of things. And, you know, I know Public Works Department doesn't want the sidewalks to be heaved, and so you know, like, yeah, these are all important things that if you want the Planning Commission can look at that.
Would it be something that if they're looking at doing that, the in neighborhoods such as like that historical home district, we can maybe see about a grant to move the power lines underground in those, or start moving toward that direction around the city, as far as like one street at a time, one year at a time, and eventually not see power line there.
Yeah, so those are actually policies that we put into our comp plan that would actually need to be put in the comp plan. Say like underground existing power lines to
that one's in there for future growth, I believe, right? Or is it there for the existing if the modifications are made to those?
Well, I see what you're saying, that not going back retro.
Retro.
There may or may not be. We can look into it. And if we have policies in our comp plan that say things like we want to underground existing power lines for whatever reason that we choose, then that goes a long way towards getting us a foot in the door for grants, if there are grants for something like that.
It's just not power. Because once you start going on the ground, it's power. Got communication, you got a whole bunch of things that run across those poles.
Yeah.
Like, you have a choice between Comcast or Ziply. I just have fiber optic installed in my house. I love it. So, that's got to go in the ground as well. So,
it would be an effort.
It would be cool. Yeah, it'd be
great. It would look a lot better. It would be worth the effort.
And it protects the street trees. You don't have to top the street trees when you get tall.
In addition to Mayor Johnson's idea about trying to do something about the sidewalks that are existing. In my ward, there are a lot of streets that just don't have sidewalks. In my house, neither neighbor has a sidewalk. I'm the only one on my whole block on that side that has a sidewalk. So you know, I see people trying to walk through the grass on the side or seemingly unsure if they should be walking in that grass to cut over to my sidewalk and kick back over to the street. Is there anything we can do to, I don't want to force people to do it, but if there is anything we can do to help them or encourage it.
Bring it into the 21st century.
Yeah, that would be nice.
So the Public Works Department has a sidewalks repair, and I'm not sure if it talks about building new sidewalks where there aren't, but they have a sidewalks plan. It's part of, they also have a pedestrian plan, the non-motorized transportation plan that addresses these things. Sidewalks are expensive, and what we do is if somebody's building or doing remodel, major remodel of their home, we can require them to put a sidewalk in. But sometimes it doesn't make sense, in your case, when there's one house and there's none for the rest of the block. But it is a tool that we can use to kind of string together pieces where if there's a sidewalk, say, next door, we're like, oh, yeah, you have to extend that sidewalk. And then in the long run, remember, in the planning department, 20 years is a short period of time. So you could say, like, well, nobody's, you know, so you build a sidewalk on one house today, but it's just going to be there like that for 20 years before the one next door does. And I'm like, oh, 20 years, great. That's not so long down the road. But we do have tools to implement sidewalk creation like that. It is tricky. It is slow.
Yeah, I figured it would be. If that's something we could wait into a little bit, I've heard interest expressed in that by constituents. I highly doubt they understand the timetable they'd be looking at for that.
They're, you know, if people want to put their money where their mouth is, there are ways that to be able to do that. There's something called the Utility Local Improvement District, where the people choose to tax themselves. They get together in a geographic area and say, hey, you know, we, the property owners on whatever street, want to put curb, gutter, sidewalk, and streetlights on our street. And we're willing to pay for it. So by putting that district together and passing the ULID, you know, they have to meet a certain number of property owners, have to agree. And then the city can go ahead and commission the project to be built and make it happen, and then charge everybody an assessment on the property. Kind of done this with sewer in the past on State Street and other various places. It's been a long time since we've done anything like this. I did not know about that one.
Is there literature on that as far as like,
there's a section of code.
As far as like the cost or what that would mean for people, as far as like, if we want to do sidewalks, this would be a general amount if we got so many houses, some sort of a brochure to bring to an end.
We do have a card. We do, because it is when I came on as mayor, I did that. I had my sidewalks repaired.
Well, that's the repair. That's the repair one, not the ULI, not the ULID creation.
Yeah. Yeah, if the neighborhood wanted to increase their value within their neighborhood and they wanted to put sidewalks and street lamps and they all agreed that's something they want to do, could they have a brochure to in that neighborhood sell the idea to each other? I think our neighborhood's fine. I'm not trying to advocate that in ours. But maybe so, right? And it's something that would be cool to see the brochure and see what the brass taxes on something like that and see if people wanted to do it. And maybe not this year, but next year the neighborhood gets back together for the barbecue and says, hey, anybody thought about this? So it'd be cool to see a brochure on something like that.
It would be. Prices change daily.
For sure.
I mean, it'd be a general.
Put a disclaimer at the bottom. Fine print.
And what sort of, like, is there a way that we could disseminate that information more, too? Because neighbors don't really talk like they used to either. But there may be an actual consensus that there are amongst neighbors. And, you know, maybe they do want to see something happen, but they have no idea what the heck a ULID is. And you know, it'd be nice to have that information readily available versus something that's maybe just buried in a comp plan that, you know, like you said, it's full of legalese that, you know, you And I, who work in law, can roll my eyes back. And,
good eye rate.
Yeah. But she sleeps sometimes.
I'm a little outside my element on this because this is definitely a public works department type process. I'm aware of how they work, and that's about the extent. So I apologize if I don't have a whole lot of expertise in the area. This is something that we would need to loop back with Mark Freiberger to talk more about. But it's a great idea. These are the kind of conversations that we have the opportunity to talk. To a certain extent, we do have two other things on the agenda today. So
I wanted to get something real quick before we go to.
Go
ahead. Okay. An issue that I've seen my entire life, but it seems to be growing, is lineal thinking versus web or spherical thinking. We tend to have a problem, and please let's not get an argument going about housing, but housing is a problem. We have a horrible housing problem in the state and across the country, and it's really easy to look at that and say, oh, we just need to build more houses, and where can we do that? Oh, well, we can just do this, or we can just do that, and that's what I call lineal thinking. When you do any action, you create a lot of ripples, okay? You know, it's like throwing a rock in the water, and it just goes like this. And I just would like to get everybody to think more about the web that you're creating when you do something. So when you make it, when you set your mind to solve a problem, you need to think a lot about the other things that you're going to affect along the way. If you put apartment buildings up, you have to have more fire trucks. If you have more crime because you have people packed in tighter in apartment buildings, you have to have more police than a city that has less. I'm not arguing these points. I'm just bringing up that you have ripple effects that are created. Insurance premiums go up because of decisions that we make and developers make every day. These all affect us. You might be able to get the price of housing down for a person to get in by putting an ADU in the yard, but it also increases the value of the property, which makes it more expensive and more taxes and more whatever. And so anyway, I just want you to think about the fact that every decision you make, if you do it in a lineal way, you're going to cause a lot of things you're not expecting. We need to think. And so really quickly, some of the things that we talked about already tonight, like the street trees is awesome. Width of right-of-ways for trees. You know, we have our right-of-ways so narrow now that when the wind blows hard, they just fall over, right? Because they are only, if they get hit broadside, they're growing their roots lineally, and they just blow over, right? Because they don't roots the other direction because of the concrete. One of the things I'm really, really worried about is when we follow other cities' jurisdiction, we look at their plans. Okay, well, we need to do this with our comp plan, or we need to solve this problem. What are other cities doing? Well, we should look at what other cities are doing, but that doesn't mean we follow them specifically, right? So if every other city in our jurisdiction is building a bigger, hotter heat island, and that's going to be a problem in the near future, we need to be thinking about how we're going to add that density and not create a bigger heat island, right? Otherwise, we're just following other cities down the same path to the same bad end that they have. So again, I'm just begging everybody to think more spherically about our things. And I think we all do, but we don't want to rush to really quick solutions that seem like silver bullets that may or may not be silver bullets in the end. Enough said.
So, Pat, I appreciate what you're saying, and thank you for sharing that. And the article that I mentioned earlier, that's exactly what it talked about. So I even have examples in my neighborhood where there's a large home, it's a beautiful home. They've made it into a fourplex, but you wouldn't know it looking from the outside because of the way that they have done it. So there's things like that we can do where we can actually support that kind of housing, and yet it doesn't have to diminish the way our neighborhoods look or even the feel or the look that we want of the town. So, yes, I appreciate. Thank you for sharing that.
Getting back just real quickly, so you know, some of the stuff that we were talking about, you made mention that, you know, it's more in the public works realm. Would it be possible that at our next session together, we could put that on the agenda so that, you know, Director Freiberger could be here and maybe answer those questions? Because I agree with you, and it's a subject that's come up quite often, and it seems like since I've been on planning commission, it's come up almost yearly, is the whole beautification and landscaping because I think there really is something to be added to that. I think that it really adds to the historic element of our town, which I think is what we all love as people who live here and grown up here, but it's also something that has always attracted others to come here as well. But then also kind of looking at it from that web standpoint of how does it affect fire? Like if we plant a whole bunch of trees, does that impede upon firefighting? You know, to pick on one example, you know, there's crabapple trees. I've heard citizens talk about up on Gateway Heights that, you know, it's a great concept to have having the trees, but like what kind of trees, you know, does it create a nuisance within the community that is, you know, unnecessary? So it'd be nice to be able to have that discussion. Maybe that's a good opportunity at the next joint meeting as we're talking about actually moving forward with comp plan revisions. Because I think that these are all great topics, and I would love to have Director Freiberger's input on that and really kind of push forward with kind of a framework of how we want to tackle those issues, actually address them instead of just talking about them.
Thank you. Anyone else before we move on to our next item? Okay, hearing none, John, I'm going to turn it back over to you, and we're going to be talking about encampments.
All right, shifting gears. Grab my notes, excuse me. All right, so this is a memo from me talking about proposed amendments to create a new chapter in our zoning code to address state requirements for homeless encampments operated by religious organizations. It has my name on it, but Emily has written this, and so I'm gonna turn this over to Emily. I want you to introduce yourself, since I don't know that anybody has met you yet, and give us the update.
Yes, thank you, John. Good evening, Council, Planning Commission, and Mayor. I'm Emily Gildner. I work with Nikki Thompson. I'm one of the partners at the law firm here. So I'm actually going to be giving you two presentations tonight. This one on safe parking accommodations and homeless encampments. We have had to look at these similar issues for some of our other cities. So I thought I would jump in on this for you all. The city has been approached by some religious organizations about possibly hosting these types of safe parking accommodations, potential encampments. Upon review of code, when the city was asked, well, what's the process for getting this started in the city? There were no regulations. And as noted in the memo that has John's name on it, but actually came from me, in 2010, the state legislature adopted a statute, 35A21360, that does not allow cities to prohibit these types of activities. So without any regulations, they are allowed to be hosted by religious organizations within your city with only the requirements set forth under the state statute or those requirements that are set by the religious organization. With that in mind, we thought that we wanted a little bit more regulation within the city limits as to when and where and what kind of public input is going to be provided so that the neighbors in the community have an idea of what is going on. Since this is the first time you are seeing it, I'm going to walk through the proposed amendments a little bit. This is actually a great opportunity with the Planning Commission here, since this will have to go through the Planning Commission, as these are considered development regulations. It'll have to go through that entire process. If there are questions, feel free to let me know, but I'm going to go through this first and then we can go over this. This is modeled after the city of Mount Vernon. The city of Mount Vernon has a little bit more flexibility in their code because they adopted these regulations prior to 2020. 2020, the state legislature adopted additional amendments that further limited some of what cities could do as far as timeframes or amount of encampments or safe parking accommodations that are allowed within the city limits. So there's two parts of this. The first one has to do with actual homeless encampments. So that's really what you are thinking of, you know, when you think of homeless encampments, when there's tents or cars or anything set up in a specific area. That is good under this proposed amendment. That would be a permitted process. Again, right now, that could come in without any permitting by the city. And so we've laid out some of the permitting processes here under 17.110.020. So this would be an entirely new chapter within your city code. So this is limited to religious organizations because that's what the statute allows us. At this point, we don't have any limitations necessarily. We just can only limit it to religious organizations. So that's what we've done here. So it'd have to be some sort of church or other worship facility or owned by them as part of their mission and their religious expression. So we have several different types of requirements. There's an encampment host. So that's going to be the physical location as to where the encampment may be located. This can be the same or it can be different from an encampment sponsor or manager. So a other nonprofit could partner with a religious organization to host an encampment on that religious organization's property, in which case the church or whatever religious organization would be the host, the physical site, and the manager or sponsor would be the nonprofit. Again, since we've limited it to religious organizations only, that does limit some of the available space that these encampments could be located at. It requires contact information for both the encampment host and for the encampment sponsor or the manager who's going to be located at the encampment site. This is important information for the city so that we know who to contact if there are safety concerns, if there are fire concerns, if there are other public health concerns. That's largely what the statute is focused on in regulations, is how to mitigate potential public health hazards. And so that's what we've done in this. In these code amendments. Again, they're modeled after Mount Vernon, but they're tailored to the size and potential needs of Cedro Woolley. For example, Mount Vernon allows encampments of up to 100 people on religious organization property. Mount Vernon is also roughly 3 times the size of Cedro Woolley, so we've pared that down to, I believe, 35. No more than 35 people could be at an encampment. Again, that's if the space allows. So that's not saying that any encampment size could be 35 people. There is discretion within the permitting process if it is a much smaller space that it's not safe for that many people to be there, that the permit can be denied. But again, these regulations are important because right now you don't have anything available for the city to regulate these types of activities. So there's various other types of facilities that are required both under state law and now through the city code as far as solid waste management, bathroom facilities, food facilities, and all of those have to comply with, you know, Skagit County public health requirements. And so a site plan that shows that as far as where those facilities would be located, how people would be able to access them. And again, this is important so that the city can make sure that there aren't public health hazards either to those who are in the encampment or to the surrounding neighborhoods. So we've got some other requirements as far as transportation, a transportation plan. So we'd have to make sure that it's not going to be blocking other parking for citizens. In my discussions with John and the mayor and a couple of other staff members, we were concerned about, you know, noise and light affecting other residents around. So we have some various screening requirements as far as fencing requirements that, you know, any type of generators or anything that makes noise throughout the night would have to be cut off at, I think it's 10 p.m. we have in here, to ensure that it's being as least intrusive on the neighbors as possible, again, within the confines of state law. So this would be a type 2 permit under your code, which goes through the administrative process and gives the planning director some discretion to review these. And if you have specific questions on that process, I will refer them over to John, as I'm not as familiar with your permitting process, but that's how we've set it up. I think one of the most important pieces of this is that a public meeting is required. So there is required notice to be given to those within 600 feet of a proposed encampment, and an opportunity for those citizens to be able to discuss with the encampment host and sponsor their concerns about everything that that may be brought to this situation. Excuse me. So this would include mailed notice to anyone within 600 feet. This would also include posting those like land use change signs that you'll see for other types of land use actions. And again, this is a temporary permit. We have it limited to 6 months per site every 18 months, I think is what we had landed on. Again, those are some of the, it's 4 months. Sorry, I'm getting the encampment versus the safe parking a little confused in my head, but I'll get to clarify those in a second. So we do have limitations on the amount of time an encampment can be there and when a site can reapply to host an encampment. So 030 of the new chapter does allow for, or does list the requirements for the approval and operation. As I said, so it's provision for drinking water, disposal of human waste, of solid waste, and other types of services. So food services, we have requirements to meet the city's solid waste diversion. So if there's any other requirements that you have within your code, those are all requirements for approval. Someone has to be on site. There are security concern or security regulations that would go through the police department to ensure that there is adequate security for the encampment. There are setback requirements. So if, you know, there's a property that goes right up to a neighbor's house, you're not going to be able, and because we do have screening and fencing requirements, you're not going to be able to have the encampment up right up to that neighbor's window. There are going to be the setback requirements that you have elsewhere in your code. As you see, the fencing is a 6-foot requirement, so fairly high up to be able to ensure that the surrounding neighbors do have some of that protection. Any lighting has to be faced away from potential neighbors. And no children would be allowed in these encampments. If there were children that were found there, this would be a turnover to CPS. There's also a prohibition on drugs and alcohol, violence of any kind, gun, knives, any other kind of weapons. There is a screening process for potential sex offenders or other people that may have warrants to ensure that they are not allowed in the encampment, or that can be a basis for revoking the permit, in which case then everyone would have to leave. Again, a prohibition on no open flames, no trespassing. Any of these things, if they were to be violated, could result in the permit being revoked and the encampment needing to break down. So there are some protections for the surrounding neighborhoods if these encampments are not observing the rules that have been placed. There are also quiet hours. I believe we've put it to 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. So again, there's limited impact for the surrounding neighborhoods. Additional access for fire or medical in case there's an emergency. So the encampments are, the encampment permits would only be available for a maximum of 120 days every 18 months. So it can't be more than about 4 months at one location, and it would take another 18 months to be able to reapply for that situation. That doesn't preclude a sponsor or a manager from applying at a different physical location, but we have set a spacing requirement of 750 feet from the previous location. Again, to as much as we can encourage any of these impacts to be spread out over the community, and so that one neighborhood in particular isn't bearing the brunt of these potential encampments just because they are located closer to a religious organization that may have more capacity. There are some hardship exceptions. Again, this is required by state law. Each of these permits has to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis. And again, that's a requirement under state law to be able to look at that. The rest of the code for the decision criteria, again, that's under the type 2 permit process and the revocation of permit. So as I said, any of those conditions that are on the permit would be a result of potential revocation if they are violated and would require the encampment to be broken down. And those are decisions that could be appealed to the hearing examiner, as with other type 2 permits in this case. So that's the encampment piece. Are there any questions before I go into that, or do you want me to go into the safe parking and we can discuss it all together? I feel like I threw a lot of information at you.
Yeah, it sounds like there's lots of questions here, Emily, so I'm going to open it up.
Okay.
So can a religious organization, do they have to just use their own property, or can they go out and lease property somewhere where there's enough space and then put in a permit for that space? Does it have to be next to their church, or does it can it be out anywhere?
So it's a religious organization. So our definition, which follows the state law, is a religious organization that has the legal right to occupy the site of a temporary homeless encampment or safe parking. So theoretically, if they entered into a lease and were paying for that at a certain location, they could do that.
So it's between them and the landowner, and not just on their own property.
Correct. Yeah. The land, whoever is the landowner would have to agree to that as well.
What if that site isn't permitted for that particular use? So here's an example. Let's say somebody has a really large parking lot and the commercial property isn't being utilized anymore, whatever the situation is. That is not permitted use for housing in that particular zone. Does that mean our zone goes out the window and all our code doesn't need to be respected? It's up to a religious organization. There could be anything these days, quite frankly. And the independent landlord that can violate what the rules are in that particular zone.
So unfortunately, the answer is more yes. Again, it's limited to 120 days and every 18 months at a particular site. So the situation that you're describing, whoever the landowner is may not be, that's not a very economically viable option, but it is something that they could do. If it is a religious organization that owns or has a legal right to occupy the property and they want to host an encampment at that site, then unfortunately state law says that we can't prohibit that.
Yes, go ahead. Okay, so what do we do when the time is up? So if they have 120 days but the tenants have nowhere to go, can you really kick them out of there if there is nowhere else for them to go? Or will we be stuck with them in this encampment because that's a loophole?
So, I mean, there are ways within code enforcement to be able to remove them. I don't know if I would want to discuss all of the legal options that the city has to physically remove people from the property after the permit has expired. But there are options for the city to ensure that that encampment complies with its permit time. Part of the other issue with that is that whoever's hosting it is going to really lose the ability to host future encampments if that's part of their mission, if they don't take the initiative to ensure that it is broken down and that those people are removed from that physical location. There are some other options for the city, but those would be kind of discussed on a case-by-case basis if they were to come to fruition, and we would want to explore our options on how to move them to ensure that it's not just being permanent, essentially.
And then how many churches can apply at one time? If every church in Woolley wanted to do this, they would all be able to do it, or just one?
So we looked at trying to limit it to one. Unfortunately, the state law had amended that in 2020. So yeah, anyone. And they could all do it. Again, that's the problem right now also, is that they could all come and just start an encampment right now, and there's nothing that you can do about it.
Emily, so one thing I just want to clarify, I think one thing that we did talk about was that if an agency or a church decided that they wanted to host an encampment, it's up to them to vet the individuals coming in. Is that not correct?
And that's 100% correct.
And it is also them who have to determine that vehicle is a viable vehicle. One that can be driven in and out, not one that's, you know, that breaks down. We need vehicles that run, correct?
Correct. And that's specifically called out in the safe parking regulations for people who are who live in their vehicles. Those vehicles have to be operational to qualify for the safe parking accommodations, or they can be removed per other codes that you have regarding parking or junk vehicles and those kinds of things. So there is a requirement that the encampment manager and host are ensuring that everyone is vetted. So again, that there's no outstanding warrants, that there's no sex offenders that are going to be limitations of if it's near a school or preschool or anything, that is not going to be allowed at all. And that again is on the encampment sponsor or manager, or they are going to be held responsible for violating the permit and would go through our code process there. And for the safe parking regulations, the vehicles do have to be in working order, so someone can't tow in a vehicle and camp there for the 180 days that is allowed under state law and then tow their vehicle out or just leave their vehicle and leave.
Can we define those, the process and report it? So the host comes out and says, oh, it's okay, this person isn't a sex offender, or this is the situation, they're not drug users. Well, there's a lot of ways to compile that data. Who do they take that data to show the city that they're in compliance? Do we get to set those guidelines of what types of background checks they need to follow? For instance, if you're getting a credit report on Experian, TransUnion, or whatever. For instance, I'm a wrestling referee, so we get background check every year nationally through the FBI to make sure that wrestling referees aren't sex offenders, don't have any type of violations. Is there something that we can put in the code to make sure whatever due diligence they're doing is defined in a manner that we can back up as well? Because that's important. I see a little bit of a loophole here, and it's just on the host that wants to do this, but they need to run that up the line. We need to make sure that that data is valid. Would you agree?
Yes. So under the current proposed code, that is all part of the security measures. And so we've left it actually a little bit open-ended that they have to provide us with how they are going to. So it's including the criteria for rejection of a resident, their code of conduct they're going to establish for the encampment, the neighborhood security patrols, how they will implement any outstanding warrant or sex offender background checks, and whether any of the residents may be ejected based on the results of those checks. They have to provide us all of that information. And then during the permit process, it'll be reviewed by the planning department, by the chief of police, by the fire chief, those kinds of things. And if it is not up to the level that those members can verify or are comfortable with in establishing those security measures, that can be a basis for a denial or telling them to go back and they need to provide additional information. They need to, you know, update what kind of background check that they're doing because what they've provided is not something that is what the city can verify. So they need to go back and do that. So that is a requirement under 020C8.
Sarah, did you have I want to know who's going to be paying for the additional calls, police, extra garbage, all of that. Who's responsible for that?
So as right now, if someone were to come and bring in an encampment, that is any increased funds or any increased calls or costs are just part of what the city has to provide. Again, I want to make clear that these are the regulations that we think help the city control what you can do, because right now all of them could come in and there's no regulations whatsoever to be put in place. You have no control over what the religious organization wants to implement right now.
Right, but the religious organization is going to be—they're going to have to do the garbage. They're going to have to do the sandy cans. They're required to do all of that.
Yes, yeah, that is part of that. So any food service, any of the water, any you know, the screening—that's all the responsibility of the host and the sponsor or manager.
And I'm actually, in regards to that, more concerned, because that's clearly outlined, but I'm more concerned with our first responders in the sense that they're already stretched thin with the calls that they're going on to facilities with licensed care people already staffed, multiple calls a day, and now they're going to a facility that we're being told we have no control over what's going on there. The amount of calls that are happening, there's just a possible manager on site or manager available by phone call that's going to be the person of contact when we've got up to 35 people there that are of one person or one small group's responsibility that's going to be impacting their calls and taking them out of service to the community and the taxpayers that are being paid and paying into these services.
Yeah, so actually these regulations help mitigate some of those issues because we do have standards for how many people could be there. We do have standards for making sure that there is emergency access. We do have standards for, you know, waste and drinking water and having somebody else on site right now, which is a requirement. To ensure that those things are implemented and hopefully that there is, you know, someone in that kind of buffering zone to deal with smaller issues because someone is there without having to call the police because there's no one else for them to turn to. So yes, this was the concern when we were like, okay, well, what's our process for how, if a religious organization does bring this, because the city's been asked as to what the process is. And there is no process. So not having a process, leaving it up to the individual religious organizations would create an even greater burden on those first responders. This way, we at least have some control over the needs that we need. If you see other requirements that are not listed in here, those are things that we can discuss to see if they are compatible with what we are allowed to do under state law as far as adding it as a regulation. But we've been very comprehensive modeling after Mount Vernon, Bremerton, and a couple other cities to ensure that we have covered almost every area that we can regulate so that the city does have control and can mitigate those costs to the best of their ability as far as what state law allows.
Does state law allow you to determine the proximity to schools and having that considered?
What's the exclusion zone on schools and parks?
Unfortunately, they don't have that. It's, again, if it's owned by a religious organization. Grant, like I said, if there are people with outstanding warrants or sex offenders, they are prohibited from being in relation to those activities. And so they would have to be rejected. They can't be a part of the encampment. And again, the application would have to show how they are verifying who is coming in. And if we at any point find any evidence that that was not the case, that they didn't do their due diligence or that they violated their permit, we can revoke that permit and we can request that the encampment be broken down and that those people disperse.
Okay. So I just want to say, So we still have something else that we need to cover. We are going to be bringing this back to the council, so you will see this again. We wanted to introduce this tonight because of situations that are happening in neighboring cities. And because I was actually approached about what do we do, as Emily said, what's the city's regulations regarding encampments? And of course, I immediately panicked and called all the powers that be and said, what can we do to protect ourselves? And this is probably the best that we've come up with. I'm not happy about it either, Sarah.
Well, one of the things, if we're going to, I know we need to move on, but just in just this whole process thing, in this situation, we're talking about notice being sent out within 600 feet of the proposed accommodations. We're required to be within half a mile of a transit for public transit. So it would be my suggestion to extend that at least within walking that half a mile walking distance as a perimeter. I would even go so far as saying a mile around, so you have surrounding community members fully aware of what is going on. 600 feet is not enough.
If I may, yes, start.
Just a moment. He had his hand up first.
Emily, can you speak to? How does this interplay with, like, say, the Landlord-Tenant Act or some other act in regards to residency? Because, you know, I know from professional experience that when a landlord, and I don't know if these encampees will technically have a tenant status, but if there's problems, which 9 times out of 10, when you do a good favor, my experience has been it usually goes awry, and then the law is skewed towards the tenant. So how does this interplay with that or some other statute?
So that's a very good question. That does come up frequently because I know, especially with everything that happened during COVID, a lot of landlords got stuck in those positions. So it's actually exempted out from considering these to be tenancies. So, and especially if we have the regulations in place to make this a separate permit and we're following the state statute in that case, this is not going to be considered a landlord-tenant situation, and where we may be stuck with having people establishing any sort of squatters' rights or any of those other types of concerns that have kind of skyrocketed in the last couple of years. This allows us to really limit what that scope is and control the encampment to simply be a safe place for this setup for a specified period of time, and then again to extend it out to other locations within the city so that one neighborhood is not impacted continually.
So just a quick follow-up to that then, is there an actual process in place then if they are exempt from landlord tenancy for the religious organization to evict problem, and for lack of a better term, tenants that may, you know, plop themselves down these encampments?
So since they are not tenants and they don't enjoy any of those tenancy rights, if they are violating any of the provisions of this and manager or host needs to get them out of there, at that point they would be considered trespassers and could be cited as such. Could be removed in that case. So it's specifically in removing it from those types of situations, and they are no longer, what we would call invitees or licensees. They become trespassers if they're violating any of these provisions or regulations.
So, Mr. LeBlanc. Oh,
thank you, Madam Mayor. So, Emily, I would just add on paragraph 5 of the ordinance, it says no more than one temporary encampment shall be permitted in the city at any one time. But you stated that that's not the case, that anyone could be done. So maybe a little clarification on that. And would we have any control over possibly a refundable impact fee that's rather large in the way of possible impact it may cause with an eviction? What that would cost for our first responders time and that kind of stuff. And if there's no problems, then part of that impact fee is back refunded to them as a way of protection.
So thanks for pointing out the paragraph 5. We, like I said, initially when we were going through this, we did want to limit it to one temporary encampment. However, upon further review of the statute, we realized in 2020, this legislature's updated that so that that's not an option for Cedro anymore. Had we updated or had we adopted regulations prior to 2020, like Mount Vernon did or Bremerton did, we would be able to limit it. And so we'll need to amend that whereas. So thank you for catching that. As far as the impact fees, again, because this is a First Amendment religious organization issue, we can't do necessarily an impact fee. We can do a permit fee. We've been once we know what the regulations are for reviewing the permit, John was going to look through as far as what actual staff time would be required in evaluating these applications, and we can impose a reasonable permit fee. We don't know what that would be at this time, but essentially it's just to cover staff time in processing these applications. So that would be planning department staff, police staff reviewing it, fire staff reviewing it, those kinds of things. But that's the extent of the fees that we can impose upon the religious organization.
So, and Stacey, you
had
a question?
I didn't have a question. I have a statement. I'm on the other end of all of you, I guess. I am very upset with some of the comments I've heard tonight about homeless people themselves and being stuck. And, you know, we have a homeless problem. We're not as bad as Seattle. There's something that has to be done. Everybody always says, what can we do about this? Now there's something that somebody's trying to do. You know, maybe you don't like it, but they're here already. They're in town. I see them all the time. I had one break my son's antenna off his car the other day at an intersection and whacked the windshield with it 50 times tonight, and he took off. This guy's crazy. I admit there's some cuckoos out there, but they're trying to help some of these people. So I have to say I'm very upset with the way every one of you have acted. I really, all of you have acted, and what some of your comments have been about this. this. Something has to be done. We're going to have to approve something. That's what I'd like to say.
Thank you.
So, do we have the ability to require some form of end game for this so that these are people and they need somewhere to go after the, what was it, 90 days? So 120 days, sorry. Is there anything we can require that they have a plan as to what's going to happen at the end of that 120 days so that they have some place for them to go, presuming that they haven't figured out something else?
The person or the organization?
The organization having a requirement or having a requirement on the organization that they know where they're going to try to move these people to, that there's some reasonable plan that they're working with another church in another town or working with a church across town, something like that, so that at the end of that 120 days, we don't just have a whole bunch of people who've gathered who are now absolutely homeless with no place to go.
Or we sell them.
Or services, getting them into services like Seattle's doing.
Yes, anything of that nature, I guess.
That is a good point. I haven't seen that in any of the other cities, and I haven't seen that addressed in state law. So that is not something that we had considered. Our consideration kind of said, well, what happens if they want to just move to the church across the street? And so that's where we implemented the larger one. So we can't necessarily require them to have something that would move outside of the city. But I can certainly look into potential, you know, reasonable recommendations of kind of an exit strategy, if you were, to hopefully facilitate that. I mean, a lot of people in who use homeless encampments tend to be service resistant. And so that's why I'm not sure that we would be able to require anything of the religious organizations, since we can't prohibit them from establishing at a different place. We can just impose reasonable regulations. But we can certainly, as part of their application, ask them to consider that and provide some information as to what they're going to do to try and facilitate getting people out of that situation.
Yeah, if there's no state requirement saying we can't do it, I'd like to require that they at least make a solid statement as to their expectation. Yes, I understand expectations change and these people all have free will, but I would like to see a requirement for the organization to have a plan that they believe will work to help these people move on after that time period.
I can certainly look into that.
I thought that we did suggest that they have social services or they bring in social services so that is provided for those who are there.
Yes, we do have some of those requirements that they have services available for people. Again, we have the requirement that there has to be, that if they are just moved, like if the sponsor is just moving an encampment site, that it has to be at least 750 feet from the previous location. We do have some of those, but we can put in some additional requirements that they provide, I guess, a transition plan for when the permit expires. And again, I don't think we can require them to do anything, but we can put some language in there. I don't think that's a bad idea at all.
Just two quick questions. I know we're short on time. They're mostly on scenarios that would fall under these definitions. I know a couple of churches that work with nonprofits that house families in their church. I just want to make sure that they do house families, and I know it's a really important program, and I don't necessarily want to loop them into this because I know that there's a no child policy. On section 15F, it talks about, you know, if the religious organization houses them in buildings on their property, that's currently what they're doing. And I just want to be careful we don't make a policy that would exclude what's currently working well for these families.
Yeah, so The mayor had brought that up previously, and from what I understand, that situation is going, or that what they're doing right now would not fall under the definitions of these encampments, because it's not, from what I understand, there's more structure to that housing availability and those programs that those families are involved in, that it would not apply to this code provision.
The people who are actually trying to move out of this situation in the transition, much different, more structured program. It's a good point.
Sorry, yeah, just the second one. Yeah. I had talked to a community member that works with the homelessness quite a bit, and on the draft, one of his concerns was during the summer months when it can get really hot, every once in a while there's a heat wave where some organizations like to set up something like an encampment for the homeless to come to, you know, to get water, shelter, fans. And typically there's not 30 days notice that a heat wave is coming. So that was just the other scenario I'd like to just bring up so that we properly write the code so that it incorporates our ability to let people still do that type of activity.
Yeah, so like that, or with extreme winter weather, because again, we don't have much control over that. There is the hardship exception, so it does allow for some of that flexibility if need be. A lot of times those situations, though, are not for this 120 days. It's for the duration of that extreme weather event, which is more under the kind of an emergency situation that is permitted under state law to provide those services. So again, this is for if they're wanting to do an extended period of time. I mean, our heat waves don't usually last 120 days. They're, I mean, maybe 10 days at a long period of time. And so that kind of minimal impact, both could fall either under this hardship exception if they're actually establishing an encampment, or if they're providing those cooling services or in the winter heating services, that's not going to fall under these provisions.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Dwelling. So what type of homeless people are we talking about? This isn't helping mothers and children and fathers with their children, if it just adults looking for a free place to stay. Like, I mean, what kind of people are we trying to help here?
Well, at this point, this isn't, these aren't regulations for necessarily helping any particular group. This is establishing the standards that if this were to come into the city, what you can regulate, because at this point, again, you don't have any options. If someone wants to go and set up at any one of the church parking lots right now, all they have to do is follow state law, and you have no decision over that. You have no regulations over that. So this isn't policy as to how we're dealing necessarily with what type of homeless situations that the city is encouraging to help, like with some of the other functions that were just mentioned with the families or, you know, in extreme weather situations. This is creating a framework for the city to regulate what can already happen that you have no regulations for.
Yes. Yeah.
This is like everything you have, the whole landlord-tenant law in the state of Washington and every state in the United States is created for 1.5% of the population that breaks all of the rules and does all the things that they shouldn't do. If everybody was law-abiding and cared for their properties and paid on time and did whatever, we wouldn't have any laws. And so anyway, I'm kind of stating the obvious, but the point is that when we're writing these things, like this, we're writing them because you have to look at all the worst case scenarios. That's what you're doing. What's the worst case scenario? Here's how we're going to handle it. Here's the worst case scenario. Here's how we're going to handle it. So it sounds horrible when we're doing it, but the point is we're trying to get those 1.5% of the population that are going to come in here and do damage. We're not aimed at people who are just here to help get some help.
And also it is the obligation and the responsibility of the city and the city council, and I would even say the planning commission, that you need to look after the city as a whole and the citizens as a whole, and that their needs and thoughts and opinions need to be taken into consideration as well. So that is something that we are also trying to address. Your point is taken, Stacey, it really is, because really probably a lot of us there by the grace of God go, I, we're just maybe that close to being in a motorhome traveling or whatever from city to city. But we do need to look out for all citizens. Mm-hmm. That is our responsibility.
On everything, we need to look out for all citizens. Every decision we make. Yep.
So back to what you were thinking. We need to get something. So we get three things. We get to set requirements. We get to set responsibilities. We get to set accountability. I'm okay starting with those three bases, but you're absolutely right. Right now it's free for all. We need to get something on there with those three things in mind. Whatever they end up being, a lot of people are going to have a lot of say.
So this gets kicked to the planning commission, I guess, and then they draw up, you guys work on this, and then kick it back up.
We debated ad nauseum.
And then bring it back to the. Right. What kind of a time frame are we looking at for something to get on the?
This is big.
If Emily can turn something around quick based on the comments today, I can try to get it on the. If it's important to the council, I can try to get it on the October 18th meeting. Otherwise, it'd be November 15th city council meeting or planning commission meeting.
Has the commission got time to weigh it out?
Merely a couple, 3 weeks and everything else going on? I'd like to see a little bit more. Look at what we have here. Give John the ability. This is a lot here. This is a big deal.
So what kind of time frame do you think the commission would
look at it in November? Because we'll start on it, but we'll definitely.
I would anticipate November we can have the public hearing on it. Because we've got a draft, we've already had a chance to review it, discuss it quite a bit. So, I would anticipate, you know, we should be able to have a public hearing even at the next planning commission meeting. That whatever planning commission meeting agenda we can get it on, it's pretty tight time frame to get it on the October one. But you know, if the council feels very strongly about that, then you know, I can make that happen.
What's the consensus of the council?
I'd like to see whatever you can do to make it as hard as you can for these churches. That's what I'd like to see.
That's why November's a better fit for us. Commissioner Johnson is going on a long earned vacation. So it's just that there's a lot here to look at that we want to do it right. Again, requirements, responsibility, accountability. I absolutely agree with you. But let's not throw something against the wall and see if it sticks.
I'd be interested in hearing what the community thinks in the public hearing and seeing what the churches bring forth and what the community members bring in. When you guys get ready to do that. So I was just curious on timeline, but what it takes to get that moving along.
You would want to do it in October?
No, I'm just throwing out the fact that,
I'm not particular. It's really up to the council, depending on how fast they want this to come back to them. If the council is comfortable with the planning commission reviewing it in November, then that's easy, and that gives us ample opportunity to let the public know that there will be a public hearing on a draft ordinance, or otherwise, you know, we can. Move it up to the other option is move it up to the October 18th meeting, which is a little less time to get the word out to people.
I believe the public should have a right, or has a right, and should have the opportunity to speak to it. And we also have to make sure that we are protecting the church's First Amendment rights to what they're doing. So I don't necessarily want to press it as quickly as humanly possible, but I do think we need to get something on the book so it's not just pure free for all.
Agreed. But what we're saying is on the public hearing side, mm-hmm. things don't travel with internet time. My experience living in the city of Cedar Hill, mm-hmm. So it gives people well over a month, okay, to have this discussion and know that there is a public hearing. We hold public hearings all the time, places everything on really, really important stuff. I'm flabbergasted. I'm like, if this was my property, I'd be right there saying, hey, you know, whatever. So on something this important, oh yeah, let's give it a little bit more time. I mean, just hitting it up and not.
You're thinking November, and then by that time, get it back to the council in December or January.
Yeah, so the November 15th meeting is right before Thanksgiving. So it wouldn't come to you that, like, I think your council meeting is on the Tuesday of
the 22nd,
which would be, you know, we wouldn't be able to get it to you that quickly. So it would fall into December, the first one in December for the city council.
And you're welcome to watch the public hearing.
You know, and that first one in December is always pretty packed. There isn't one in the second one in December, but council has already reviewed it once, so you've had your one touch on it already, so you would be eligible to take action in December based on, you know, what you think of the planning commission's recommendation.
If you want to let us, I think we'll know, but let us know when that date is for the public hearing, and then we can
So if we don't act and somebody puts up an encampment right now, and then we pass an ordinance, are they grandfathered, or do they have to start complying with the law right away?
Emily, what's the answer to that?
Oh, I was hoping you didn't ask that.
Sorry.
We can impose the reasonable regulations, so they're not necessarily grandfathered in. But as with like a permit revocation, the status quo would be maintained until they went through the permit process. So if someone set up an encampment in November or December, and you pass this in January, and then they, you know, started the process for an application at that point, the encampment's not going anywhere, and they still only have to apply or comply with state law until we've completed their application. And in which case there may be some other issues that we would need to kind of flesh out. Cause I did look into this a little bit before this meeting. So I was wondering if you were going to ask that, as far as the time frame and whether those, whether we would be able to impose those on someone who is actively hosting an encampment, or whether or not their application would be the beginning point of that kind of clock time frame, in which case, you know, they have already had an encampment for 3 months, and then they could have another 4 months, and then it would be 18 months. Those questions I don't have good answers to yet. There isn't a lot of clarity in state law, and this hasn't really there haven't been cases that have established that. So that's something that we would need to flesh out a little bit more. But we could require them to start at least with the application process and start complying with those permit requirements that we've established. And then some of the timeframes we would need to think through a little bit more.
What would be our geographic area that we would regulate? Would it include our UGAs? For instance, right now, does Skagit County have any code regulating encampments? Because we're surrounded by a lot of unincorporated Skagit County. Cedar Rolly in itself is not that large. However, our UGA does expand outside of our city boundaries. So what do we actually regulate? Just in city or within our UGA?
Just within the city limits. And I don't think Skagit County has specific regulations on that, although John may be able to speak to that better. Again, this code is fairly similar to Mount Vernon, and they've had this code in place for quite some time now. So it's been fairly vetted, at least through that community, as far as managing at least. And again, we've tailored it down a little bit more to Cedro size and population. So no, you wouldn't be able to regulate in the UGA. It would just be within the city limits.
So sorry, I'm
So I think that we should spend the time to do it right the first time. I don't think it should be done in haste.
Great.
And I think the public deserves the opportunity to speak. So I think November is perfectly acceptable.
I agree.
Let me
stop
that.
Okay, with that decided, then we have one more item on our list. And I don't think the Planning Commission needs to stay for this unless they want to. Is that correct, John?
Possibilities. Yeah, the intention was to have everybody here.
Everybody here? Okay. All right. So, Emily, I'm going to turn this back over to you.
You guys are getting a lot of me tonight, so it's a nice introduction. I'm going to share my screen here. And this, I hope, should be brief. This is a kind of refresher on legislative versus executive functions. We do this periodically for several of our cities. I've done it for two or three others this year alone. So again, this isn't anything anyone did. This isn't calling anyone out. This is just periodic. And so since I was here doing the temporary encampments, we thought we would throw this in here real quick as well. Can everyone see my screen? The PowerPoint?
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Okay, perfect. So, so the main purpose of the executive versus legislative function are checks and balances. I'm not gonna play the YouTube song for you, but you know, you can check out Three Branches of Government by Schoolhouse Rock, where they talk about the three rings of circus. That's how I learned it when I was a kid. It's always fun. Additionally, I like throwing in a little history. The checks and balances goes back to Greek and ancient Rome as far as ensuring that both the legislative and the executive sides of government are watching out for each other, are balancing each other correctly, and that no one side is getting has too much power. As we know, power concentration can be problematic. So in Washington State, the Mission Springs case out of City of Spokane in 1998 really kind of established what are the consequences of not staying within either the legislative or executive function. What happens is that it can invalidate actions that are done by legislatures or the executive if they step outside of their lane as well. Individual fines, so it's not just city liability, but it's individual liability as well. Awards of attorney's fees, that's usually kind of the biggest chunk of change that gets thrown out there is when you're having to have to litigate something, the losing side is often going to have to pay not only their attorney's fees, but the other sides as well. And then potential damages. And if we're talking about in the land use arena, which tends to have the most exposure, that and employment areas, there's constitutional or civil rights violations. So Section 1983 of the U.S. Code is what's going to provide for damages. And that's where you can also get a very large sum against. So the Mission Springs case was where the city council was actually responsible for ultimately approving a permit, and they ended up arbitrarily not granting the permit, which and did not follow along with their code, which caused several issues. So real quick, mayoral authority. So this is the chief executive. Where policy and administration are separate. Council is in charge of policy decisions, and the mayor is in charge of administrative decisions. Mayors have limited ability to influence policy through vetoes of ordinances, but again, back to checks and balances, city council can always overrule the mayor's veto with a supermajority, or in your case, a 5 out of 7 of the council members. But on the flip side, the mayor is the one that's responsible for staffing decisions and direction of work. So council is only limited to broad scope within staffing, such as, you know, job descriptions or, you know, the department or budget direction of day-to-day work. It's an administrative function falling under the mayoral authority. So this kind of actually goes back to what we were just talking about, both with the comprehensive plan and the encampments, is that the legislature, the state legislature, kind of grants general authority to cities. Usually it's limited to what's specifically granted. However, as a code city, you have some broader authority. It's called home rule authority, in which case, unless it's prohibited, like we just discussed with encampments, you have broad range to make policy decisions. So as you were discussing with the trees or the sidewalks, those things aren't specifically prohibited by the state legislature, so the council can make those policy decisions as you see fit. Additionally, council can also direct some work through allocation. Since the council is in charge of the overall budget, allocating to different departments is generally the easiest way for council to prioritize what those policy decisions are. But again, ultimately, that workflow goes through the mayor as well. So I highly recommend the mayor council member handbook through MRSC and AWC. Hopefully, when you all first took office, you had a chance to review that as part of the initial training requirements that you had coming on board. So I like to think of the executive versus legislature as a menu versus a recipe, or menu versus a chef. So the council gets to set the menu, they get to create the recipes, but the chef gets to implement that. They are the ones actually creating the dishes and sending them out. So there is some discretion within the mayor as far as what recipes are getting made first versus what other items are going to be put on after those. So hopefully that's a helpful analogy. Maybe it's not. But there's also tension between those two. So it could be a really important thing for the council to prohibit jaywalking. You certainly can do that. That is something well within the legislature's right. But if, you know, reviewing the staff workload and the amount of jaywalkers that your city has, that the mayor is directing the police chief, but that's not a good use of funds at this time. That's within the discretion of the mayor. Again, council has some control through budgetary allowances. If there are areas that you would like to see additional enforcement, you know, giving additional budgetary priority to those types of enforcement, that's within council's discretion. But again, ultimately the staff direction lies with the mayor. Other issues are such as enforcement of the animal code and permit and development applications. The council sets the broad range guidelines through the comp plan, through development regulations. That's how you set your policy goals. But as far as actual approving permits and applications and the process that goes through, that's an executive function. It has to comply with code. It has to comply with state law. But within those discretionary statements, then the mayor can direct staff in that case. So I said I would try and keep this brief. Key points: council setting the standards in your comp plan, and as you discussed earlier this meeting, that is coming up and is going to be a huge undertaking. And have a lot of policy implications. So it is something, it is a really great opportunity for council to really dive into and lay out what their policy goals are as far as growth within the city. But the mayor and staff do have the discretion to interpret those overarching council or those overarching comp plan and policy goals when they're directing staff work. Communication with the public. So as elected officials, you want to communicate with your constituents, and you absolutely should. So Receiving feedback on individual matters. That's something that council certainly can do, but the council doesn't have a lot of, doesn't have any authority to then direct staff to look into that. If it's an issue that is not in code, which that happens occasionally, then that's something certainly that the council may want to bring up and certainly can. The mayor can look at those individual situations a little bit more, but has to follow whatever process the council has set up. So again, if there's no code, that may be something that the mayor, you know, recommends to council, be like, hey, the, you know, constituents have been bringing this up. We may want to have this regulation, as with the encampments. And council gets to decide the policy direction on what kind of regulations, and then the enforcement will go back to the administrative and executive side. And within personnel matters, so the council, you're generally responsible for what the different allocating budgetary distinctions for the different departments. Some cities, they adopt the job descriptions, potentially appoint or confirming various appointments for higher level positions. But the day-to-day work and administration of any of those policy goals will still rest with the mayor. So I'll take any questions. As always, the answer depends, but I am, if you have any questions on this or anything else that I've presented tonight, I am happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will keep this short as I promised.
Thank you, Emily. So are there any questions by anyone for Emily?
I thought you had more power.
Well, I mean, all right, if there is nothing else, Emily, thank you again for being here tonight, answering our questions and leading us through some really challenging and difficult topics to really discuss and take a hard look at the encampments. And probably we'll have you back. I'm guessing we will when we go through this with the council. So with that, we'll say goodnight to you and to everyone else. Thank you for coming tonight. I thought this was a really productive meeting tonight. Good questions, good suggestions, lots of information for sure. And so with that, with your permission, we're adjourned.
Okay.